the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again. Welcome to the show. Coming up, agricultural scientists are sceptical about the PM's plan that seems to rely on offsetting carbon emissions by storing it on farms. Some recent modelling has shown that because of the cost of farmers, they can either grow food or store carbon, but they can't do both.
That's essentially what we got to. It started to get very, very expensive. We were up over $1,000 a tonne, and our actual computer models were saying this is impossible.
Also on the program, we'll be looking at the issue of almond prices and drought-breaking rains in California. That's all coming up on the program. And as always, you can always send us a text on any of the stories that you hear on the program, 0467 922 684. That's the number to text me here at the Country Hour. But first up today, agricultural scientists, they're pretty sceptical about the PM's plan to offset carbon emissions by storing it on farms. Professor Richard Eckhart from the University of Melbourne says that the plan's reliance on soil carbon or growing more trees is a dangerous assumption. He says the idea of asking farmers to lock up their soil to bail out the fossil fuel industry is also quite fanciful. The trade-off for farmers is you can store carbon or grow food on the farm, but he says you can't do both. He says a warming climate as well and reduced rainfall is also putting a big question mark over how much carbon can be stored in any case.
Yeah, look, you know, the reliance on soil carbon, I think is, I'd even go so far as to say it's a dangerous assumption. And it's kind of asking the farmers to lock up their soils to bail out the fossil fuel industry, which our assessment would say that even the best outcome for soil carbon in Australia will not be enough to offset the agricultural emissions sector on its own. So this notion that soil carbon can bail out the fossil fuel industries is quite fanciful, really. You've got to remember, soil carbon is just a simple input-output equation. Input is plant growth, output is microbes. And what happens in a good rainfall year is you get lots of growth going in and the microbes send it back out. In a drought year, you get less rainfall, therefore less plant growth, therefore less input, but the microbes still send it out. At the end of the day, in a country that's 22% more climatically variable than any other country in the world, you know, soil carbon is 90% about rainfall, and you can't bank the future on something that is dependent on rainfall, and climate change is challenging that exact rainfall.
And we're seeing global warming, there's no doubt about that, and we're seeing reduced rainfall, which means productivity in Australia on farms has reduced, I would imagine.
Look, I would be bold to say that under a changing climate, we'd be lucky to hang on to the soil carbon we've got, rather than actually think that it's going to save the agriculture sector on its own, let alone save the fossil fuel sector.
Some of the other discussion is around modelling done by Mike Young has found that it would actually put food production at risk to bank too much on soil carbon. What's your thoughts on that?
To build soil organic matter, there's no downside to that. But to lock up management in agriculture to align with high soil organic matter returns is locking farmers into a long-term fixed management regime, because the best way to build soil carbon is to move out of a cropping situation into permanent pasture. That's the biggest rate of gain you will get. But what you've done is you've taken that land out of crop production and put it into livestock production, which is not necessarily as efficient in delivering human food. And that new management that you've imposed has to be maintained in perpetuity to keep the soil carbon there. You can't just sort of switch out and then go back to what you were doing before. So the idea that, you know, we're going to make a commitment on behalf of the farmers to lock them into particular management that will keep increasing soil carbon means it would have an impact on their ability to produce food off that land.
In New South Wales, in Ivanhoe and Cobar, we've seen some farmers that are actually now just carbon farmers. They don't actually run anything on. They just grow, in many cases, woody weeds, and they just leave it there to be locked up. That has, we've seen production reduced. We've seen some problems arising from that with feral animals too.
Yeah, look, you know, it was never the intention of the Carbon Farming Initiative originally to take agricultural land out of productivity. And, you know, that's an obtuse outcome that has resulted. And, you know, there are many questions about the validity of those carbon credits, because in many cases, you know, avoided deforestation doesn't actually work us towards our Paris commitment anyway. And really, the only beneficiary is cash in hand sale of goats, I would imagine, because they're the only beneficiary of that, really. You know, in order to reduce emissions, we've got to do something directly about the emissions from agriculture.
What other actions should be taken, in your view?
Look, there's no doubt that when you do the farm audits, you can see the obvious. You can try to plant trees or store carbon in soils, and there's nothing wrong with doing that, because that's all good practice. But in the end of the day, you can't build carbon forever, and you can't store in trees forever. The bottom line is, research is needed to deliver cost-effective options for farmers to respond to these targets and reduce livestock methane, reduce nitrous oxide. And the good news is, you know, in the last 20 years, we've moved from options that could only reduce methane by 20% to now options that are emerging that can reduce methane by 80%. So, you know, this idea that we need soil carbon to bail us out is not the reality. You know, Meat and Livestock Australia, the National Farmers Federation, have all cottoned on to that this is where the future is. We can do something about these emissions without threatening agricultural production.
And food production, and there's talk that our export food would be under real threat if we went down too much of this path.
Yeah, look, you know, both the United States and the European Union have made it pretty clear that they will apply border adjustment tariffs to Australian exports specifically. And so really the only question left for us is, do we keep the revenue in Australia, or do we send the carbon tax out to the European Union? At the end of the day, someone's going to have to pay. And I would say it is better for agriculture to keep the revenue it's circling in the economy, to make real adjustments here in Australia to make sure that our produce is compliant with those world markets. There's a lot of skepticism about the plan that's been put forward. The way it's tabled right now, border adjustment tariffs will be a reality. Because agriculture is 70% export focused, it's a reality for us unless we can demonstrate we've done something about it. Now, I suspect that at a sector level, we can do that. If you take MLA's carbon neutral 2030 plan, you know, that's demonstrating real action. And if that can be validated on exports, we might avoid those border adjustment tariffs.
Someone's likened the plan to, I'm going to give up smoking in about 30 years' time.
and the climate does care. That's the problem. To say we might achieve it in, you know, 30 years' time, well, in the meantime, we go up 2.7 degrees. And, you know, with the sort of the current commitment, 2.7, you know, you look at what Australia has looked like under El Nino years, where we were 1 degree above pre-industrial levels. It was a bit of a disaster for agriculture at 1 degree. So the notion that we can afford to go above 1.5, let alone up to 2.7, is a disaster for agriculture.
Richard Eckhart is a professor of agriculture at the University of Melbourne. Now, some new modellings also found that while agricultural emissions are part of the carbon problem, it's emerged that the value of carbon sequestration is being overstated. University of Adelaide professor Mike Young says if we thought we were able to just pay farmers to increase their stocks of carbon, it was found to be way too expensive. He said the trade-off is to grow food or store carbon, but you just can't do both. Ultimately, getting to net zero and staying at net zero is going to involve doing something else. And Professor Young says he believes that direct extraction or carbon capture and storage can be part of the solution.
The reality is that around about half of our greenhouse gas emissions aren't associated with the energy production. So things like air conditioning, agriculture, fertilizer use, lots of other sources of gases. And we thought we'd be able to just pay farmers to increase stocks of carbon to offset that. But we found it was way too expensive. And finally, we worked out in modelling to net zero that the economy, if it was going to prosper and do well, would also have to take CO2 out of the air and store it underground, or else turn it into something that didn't cause greenhouse gas.
So your modelling found that we couldn't sequester enough carbon on farmland and still grow some food.
That's essentially what we got to. It started to get very, very expensive. We were up over $1,000 a tonne, and our computer models were saying, this is impossible. And so we turned around and sat down and noticed in other parts of the world there is serious work going on and saying, look, it makes sense to take carbon dioxide out of the air and store it underground. And that's called direct extraction. And it's a really big opportunity. And it's critically important. The Prime Minister and everybody else is now saying net zero, not zero of everything. So it's going to always make sense, for example, to use chlorofluorocarbons to fight fires, and we won't have the nation burning because we can't fight fires, but that involves greenhouse gas emissions. And the easiest way to do it is to turn around and offset that by taking some carbon dioxide out of the air. It's not rocket science.
But I thought it had been discredited, that science, you know, the idea of sequestering carbon. I mean, hasn't the biggest facility in the US, haven't they just destroyed that?
I think it's still going ahead as far as I know. It's expensive still, but so is making hydrogen and lots of other things. There's technology that has to be developed, and people are saying in the US and elsewhere they can do it at the moment for about $200 a tonne. We modelled it at $100 a tonne, which assumes there would be significant breakthroughs and reductions in cost. But there are lots of opportunities in Australia to store CO2 underground using carbon capture and storage. And this is just carbon extraction and storage. And certainly there, if we don't do this, then we've got a massive economic problem. Also in our model, Michael worked out what it would cost to do this, and it's about $16 billion Australian dollars a year. So it's a lot of money that we would have to do under current policy frameworks.
So is it a lifeline to the current coal industry where they could sequester carbon and still burn coal?
I'd be surprised if that would add up. Certainly our models said that, in fact, you would shut down coal industry. But the other thing we did, and this is the first to ever attempt to model regional detail, and when we modelled what would happen region by region in Australia, and we set out, for example, split off actually southeast Queensland from the rest of Queensland, every part of Australia experiences an increase in jobs and an increase in regional income as we go to net zero. We were really surprised by this.
Are there other ways of doing it? If you really crank up renewables, if you really crank up hydrogen production, if you really crank up solar and wind, and can you reduce the carbon that that is actually needed in the economy to the point where you don't have to offset it by creating a sort of carbon sucking machine?
There will always be a need for some carbon sucking machine of some sort. At least I think there will always be a need for it. I can't see us getting to having zero from all sources. There'll always be some emissions. Clearly, though, what we've modelled is the current government pathway, which is get down to 26 to 28% measured against 2005 by 2030.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what sort of policy changes do you think would be better put into place to get us quicker to a reduction in carbon or a net zero carbon sort of economy?
We have looked at this only very superficially at this stage, and that's the next part of the modelling work that we're planning to undertake. But we modelled current policy, not future policy, but clearly having some sort of price signal, having a level playing field so that hydrogen and actually renewable source of electricity compete fairly, bringing in the other sources of gases, greenhouse gases, much faster. As I said, there's a lot in agriculture, a lot associated with fertilisers, rice production, firefighting, air conditioning. Bringing all that into the plan needs to happen now so that the pathway to net zero is one that's dynamic.
So an emissions trading scheme of some sort.
An emissions trading scheme of some sort, and for farmers and actually listeners on your shows, we have a water trading scheme. Having a similar sort of framework makes a lot of sense for actually climate policy as we go forward, so that people can plan with future confidence, but knowing there's uncertainty there as well.
But it's interesting that you say we can't store all the carbon that we'd need to on the farmland we've got and still grow food. You know, we can't plant trees. Even if we planted trees everywhere and sequestered carbon in the soil, we still couldn't do what we'd need to do to get to net zero.
Oh, we could, but we'd be running desperately short of food.
We wouldn't be able to create any food.
Especially food for export. You know, Australia's agriculture is feeding the rest of the world, and we play a very important role in that. And it doesn't make sense to switch off agriculture. The horrible part about planting trees, for example, is that once you've planted a tree and it's grown, it has to stay there forever. And if you ever chop the tree down or have a fire or anything, you lose all the carbon that you have sequestered there. So we think, and our models suggest, it would be smart to certainly improve soil carbon where you can, certainly improve management and get a greater stock of carbon throughout agriculture, which would do much for productivity as well. But ultimately, getting to net zero and staying at net zero is going to involve something else, and that will be something other than agriculture.
University of Adelaide's Mike Young, Professor of Water, Energy and Environmental Policy. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 21 minutes past 12. Got quite a few texts coming through. Bruce says there's no risk to food security with soil carbon storage. Australia exports the bulk of what it produces. And John from Narandra says Richard Eckhart's stuck in the 20th century with his soil science. Get into the 21st century with up-to-date data and methodologies, and we can do both. There are farmers producing annual crops and increasing soil carbon. It's just not the way that traditional soil science sees it. Although we just heard from Mike Young there, he was saying it's just the amount of carbon you'd have to store. You'd have to put trees everywhere and you couldn't grow any more food. That's the modelling that they've done just recently. Also, Jason says soil carbon and trees, they're temporary. To reduce atmospheric carbon, stacks of it will need to go back deep underground. And Jason says also keep the carbon rorters out of it. And also another text saying, who pays a farmer to only grow wheat? Well, a retired farmer saying that. Well, out some of the properties at Cobar, that's actually what they're doing. They've just said they're not going to touch the land. They're just getting paid carbon credits for just leaving it totally alone. And they've just left it there. It's 22 minutes past 12 on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, still on that topic, because the Maloon Institute's Gary Nairn is much more upbeat, though, about the PM's plan on carbon storage and the role of farming. He says soil carbon sequestration and the 2050 carbon neutral roadmap is a critical element to reducing emissions and reducing the impact of global warming. Gary Nairn says a huge percentage of Australian land, over 60%, he's saying, is denuded and needs to be rehabilitated, and soil carbon storage can do just that.
It's a critical element of the whole process, and I think the opportunities are great in this area, and we've been saying that for a long time. The work that we do at the Maloon Institute is all around repairing and rehydrating landscapes, and we've been able to see the flow-on effect of that in a variety of ways, and one of those is getting CO2 out of the atmosphere and putting it back in the ground where it belongs as soil organic carbon.
But I mean, there's some talk that, concern about sort of locking up farmland and just leaving it just because then you have to store the carbon that way, that's not realistic and not very productive in terms of producing food.
Yeah, well, some of the rules that were first put in place with respect to earning carbon credits has incentivize some people to do that, which I think is unfortunate, because you don't have to lock up land to store carbon, and certainly there's now a better understanding as to what can be done, that you, with good regenerative farming practices, you can still farm that land and store carbon at the same time. And the early rules, which fortunately the government is now looking at changing, meant it was sort of easier for some to put forward projects where they simply put a fence around areas and said, well, we won't clear that vegetation, therefore we'll earn these credits. But they're probably never going to clear some of that land anyway in the first place. So I think the changing rules that the government is working towards now will enable farmers to get more involved in a whole of farm basis. And that would be good for agriculture and good for our climate.
But is it going to be enough to offset? I mean, there's been some research that some scientists are saying there's no way you can really offset, you know, the carbon damage with farmland. We don't have enough. We just don't have enough farmland. And, you know, if we'd have to stop producing food to be able to just lock it all up like that and just have a sink.
Well, I would disagree. I mean, I think there's a huge opportunity to put a lot of carbon back in the soil. I think there are other things happening to reduce emissions in the agricultural sector. You know, precision agriculture, which is now sort of almost run of the mill, has cut down a lot of farm use of tractors and various other things, which add to emissions. So, you know, combined, I think they can have a significant impact. Our expertise, we see an absolute great opportunity, given the extent of land degradation that we do have across the country. We've lost probably somewhere between 40 and 60% of soil carbon over the last 200 years. So that tells you what sort of opportunity there is to get that CO2 out of the atmosphere and back in the soil. And that's certainly the demonstration. Catchments and that around the country that we're working on is starting to show that.
The government talked about possible incentives. Should we have like a carbon price incentive for farmers that would sort of encourage them to store more carbon, wouldn't it, and retain productive agriculture too? Would you be in favour of something like that?
Well, I think the incentive is already there through the commercial operations that we're seeing. And big emitters, for instance, are now interested in funding up front measurement of baseline measurement of farming operations to lock in carbon credits for as their offset for the future. And
does Maloon do that? Do you do that now?
Well, we're working with a variety of organisations on projects for that very purpose, and it's come a long way in very recent times, and we now have a number of certainly big emitters that are interested in talking. We're putting together a catchment scale project in the New England, which will be put together on that basis, and they can see the price of the commercial price of carbon going up right across the world, and therefore by getting involved in these projects they can then have some sort of certainty around what those credits will be.
Gary Nairn from the Maloon Institute. It's 27 minutes past 12. Well, still on that topic, the Carbon Market Institute has welcomed the government's plan but is calling for policies that push companies to reduce their emissions. CEO John Connor says a declining limit on pollution instead of the existing cap on emissions at current levels is what's needed to get business to drive the change to net zero. He told David Claughton the plan is an important step to move the debate forward, but some other policy levers could have been pulled as well.
Well, look, we welcome the commitment to net zero by 2050. We do think it's an important marker. It's important from an investment perspective for big infrastructure. It's important also, hopefully, that it might be mark the beginning of the end, at least, of the culture wars, and so we can actually get down and focused on the activities we need to be undertaking. We do think there's a missed opportunities in some of the investment guides and investment pools are mechanisms that are there, so just relying on a really false binary around technology, not taxes, when obviously there's lots of taxpayer money at play. But what we are keen on is to see that this is actually shifts to something which is more driven by business. We welcome money, of course, from the government, and if they have to do it that way, then we'll keep working with them. Billions of dollars that have been committed to the Emission Reduction Fund. But longer-term certainty of investment will actually be gained by using mechanisms like the government's safeguard mechanism to have a declining limit on pollution for business, and so that they actually become the investors. You have that declining over time, then business needs to invest ahead of that. If you have that in a proper carbon market, then that would also see some investments in lower cost abatement that is available in the land sector, and which can provide revenue benefits for farmers, but can also provide other benefits for ecosystem resilience and other economic benefits for communities out there in regional Australia.
Angus Taylor saying we're building voluntary carbon markets. We don't want a carbon tax, and it has been politically disastrous in the past. But what's your view about a carbon tax or a price on carbon?
Well, we're saying that they're using safeguard mechanism, which at the moment already, we do have carbon prices. So this is why I think we've got these false binaries in technology, not taxes and all these things, because at the moment your taxpayer dollar is paying on average $16.94 in the last auction we had just last week for purchasing carbon reductions. Companies are paying in the safeguard mechanism in small amounts. There was 1 million tonnes last year just short of, which were purchasing, and they're buying that in that spot market price that's well above the Gillard's pricing mechanism. So I think we need to move on with that and see what other business and other industry groups are saying. Let's have that limit. Let's have that and see that more as an investment guide, and have it's good to have the technology roadmap and its approach and focus, and some of the recent reforms we welcome in speeding up method development, and we think there's some real opportunities within that, but there's still a bigger picture that is out there to be worked on.
What else is in the plan for farmers?
Well, so there's particular opportunities. They are focusing on soil carbon. Of course, it was a big part of Tony Abbott and Greg Hunt's direct action plan, now I think we're doing a lot more of the work on integrity and the systems there, and so that has an opportunity. There are
many farmers making money from storing carbon at the moment?
Look, we've got there's a small amount that's been paid, so I think just short of 2,000 carbon credits have actually been paid, but we do know that there's significant amounts in the pipeline. There's some 900 plus projects in the pipeline. The government's been working on a new method which improves the measurement and modelling of the gains to be done there, and I think there's around 50 million hectares of pasture and cropping that could be eligible for soil carbon. So there's significant opportunity there, but we do need get on with the broader task of decarbonisation, and we do need to make sure we're working with regional communities. So we're still waiting to see what are some of the other elements and what appears to have been agreed with the Nationals for Regional Future Fund, some other questions around how agriculture is treated in some of these policies and carbon farming itself, some tax treatment.
John Connor from the Carbon Market Institute, which is a lobby group that promotes policy on emissions reduction and carbon markets. And quite a few texts have come through on that issue. We'll get to them a little bit later on. Wayne's texted in asking about accurately and economically measuring soil carbon. Wayne says his information is we can't do that yet on a broad scale, and yet the powers that be want to trade it and determine agriculture's industry's future on the basis of it. But he's saying the jury is still out on the accurately and economically measuring soil carbon. It's 28 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Let's get some news headlines now from Adam Storey. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. A bit of COVID news around today. The Pfizer vaccine could be approved for 5 to 11-year-olds by the end of November. The medical regulator has now received most of the safety and efficacy data from Pfizer about the vaccine, and the booster shots are expected to roll out from Monday, November 8th. Once the vaccine advisory body makes its final recommendations. 10 motorhomes have arrived at Kempsey on the mid-north coast amid an outbreak there. There's been 100 cases alone in the past week, and the homes will be based at the local showground. The Prime Minister says he remains confident international tourists will return to Australia by the end of the year. From November the 1st, Australians can return home at least to New South Wales and Victoria without having to quarantine if they are fully vaccinated. Treasury officials have confirmed they had little involvement in the economic modelling behind the government's net zero emissions plan. The Treasury Secretary Stephen Kennedy has told a Senate hearing that much of the modelling was actually done by consultants. And the Australian consumer prices have jumped by 3% over the past year, driven by sharp increases in the price of petrol and property prices. Bureau statistics show that inflation rose by 0.8% in the last quarter compared to the previous quarter. And I can tell you, haircuts are up around $3 to $4, which I found out after I got the haircut.
You went what?
mean, you're going to charge me $12.
And especially for that. just joking.
I've got a wash.
Well done.
Wash, blow dry, cut.
Looking good.
Thank you.
Looking good.
Feeling
okay.
Feeling $1 million.
Okay, thanks for that, Adam. Adam's story there with the news headlines and fashion advice. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's 26 minutes to one. Let's find out what's happening in the weather. And Stephen Axe at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So we're watching this weather system coming through. What's happening with that? Any changes to that? Any updates? Any more rain with it or less? What's happening?
Yes, so there's a few updates from yesterday, and I guess starting with the temperatures, that there's not much change there. We've got those very warm temperatures in the west of the state today. Over the next couple of days, as that trough and front come through, those warmer temperatures will spread to eastern parts, and rather hot in some places, so reaching the mid-30s in across the northern inland over today and tomorrow ahead of that front. But yeah, the rainfall with this, it's mostly going to be associated with local showers and thunderstorms as it moves across, and many parts of the state will be affected by that. But I guess in some parts, those showers and thunderstorms could tend to get a little bit more rainy, so generally as the showers and storms weaken, they can turn into sort of generally a lighter sort of rain band. And there's a couple parts of the state which might be potentially affected by that, and namely sort of we've got these sort of active storms just currently over South Australia, and they're kind of moving east, and that system which is producing moves into western New South Wales later tonight or early tomorrow morning. But those clusters of storms are quite localised at the moment. Showers and storms have the potential to spread out into a little bit of rainy stuff. So southwest of Alina, say about Tibooburra or Finlay, or Tibooburra and Deniliquin, is where that stuff is moving into, and we could, many places there, there's a high chance of at least seeing 1 or 2 millimetres of rain. So not heavy, but of course if you get storms, you could potentially get a locally heavy fall southwest of that line as that system moves in overnight into tomorrow morning. But generally there, it could just get a little bit wet right across that part of the region. Then if it heads further east, it's sort of more localised, it's looking. Until on Friday, it hits the sort of northwest slopes and plains and northern tablelands region, where, again, it could get a bit more rainy and widespread in that region.
Right, okay. So maybe a little bit more then as those two systems come together. Is that the idea? Potentially.
Yes, so I mentioned what's happening tomorrow, overnight and tomorrow in the southwest of the state, where, yeah, we could at least see 1 or 2 millimetres is a good chance in that southwest.
Yep.
But in the northeastern inland on Friday is a good chance at least seeing a few or so millimetres everywhere there. But with storms potentially heavier, 10 to 20 millimetres or more locally, across the region, maybe even 30 millimetres in the northwest slopes and plains on Friday locally in that region. But at least a few millimetres is looking set for most places in that region, but, of course, a bit heavier storms. Elsewhere, apart from that southwest corner tomorrow and that northeastern inland on Friday, looking more localised, pretty sure we'll get local showers and storms right across the state. But outside of those areas I mentioned, a lot of places could just miss out altogether, potentially.
So I guess what we're saying is we're not going to see, unlikely to see, large areas that will get a big dump of rain, which will impact on the harvest if people are, you know, sort of getting in or getting ready for harvesting. It doesn't seem like it's going to be widespread, a lot of, lots of millimetres of rain. It's just here and there.
Yeah, yes, that's right. So lots of millimetres would be just here and there with storms, basically. I mean, we could get a larger sort of storm, but over a whole across the region, like
fairly
southwest,
isolated.
The storms would be fairly isolated. You know, there could be 100 kilometres across, 50 to 100, perhaps. I mean, just taking a rough estimate there, where a storm could produce something heavier. But yeah, vast areas, like in that southwest and northeast inland, could only maybe expect a couple or a few millimetres.
Mm. And looking further ahead, what can we expect then?
Well, then that change moves through, that front moves through on Saturday, so it contracts the weather to the northeast corner, mostly on Saturday. Also should mention that over the few days, the storm's possibly severe, and of course that will continue into Saturday. Then the cooler temperatures start moving in into the west and south of the state on Saturday, and then on Sunday they should move right across the state, those cooler temperatures. As we head into next week, a little bit uncertain, but we get some more easterly winds, the odd shower around the coast as we head into next week. And the next significant front after this one, which is currently approaching, probably not until next Wednesday or Thursday.
Okay, all right. Thanks for that, Stephen.
Thank you, Michael.
It's 20 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Quite a few texts coming in about carbon soil. Someone's texted in saying, how do they measure carbon soil, carbon, etc.? Since the 1819 drought, there's been a massive amount of grass and vegetation growth in New South Wales. Wouldn't this be seeing a decrease in carbon? Bob at Byron's texted in saying, that's not right about trees. The Amazon was called the lungs of the earth, and now that's been denuded. There are massive areas around New South Wales where trees are needed, says Bob. Someone's texted in, how can we trust a government that uses technologies in its plan that don't exist to form their policies of the future? Another text, coal is the best form of carbon capture and storage. And this person says, stop digging it up, you idiots. And another text has come in about a carbon tax. If they want carbon sequestration to work, they need a price on carbon. And the experts say it's essential if nuclear power is to be considered. And by the way, most of the carbon reduction we saw that the coalition is claiming was actually achieved between 2012 and 2014 when Labor had its carbon tax in place, according to Steve at Corakai. And Ted's texted in saying, yes, the headers are fire up in the Great Narrabri Shire this week. Ted's saying, so rain is expected. So a bit of pessimism there from Ted. Fingers crossed. Maybe it won't rain, Ted. Let's hope not. It's 18 minutes to one on the Country Hour. Or reports of, talking about rain, reports of drought-breaking rain in California could impact on Australian almond growers. In recent months, the industry witnessed one of the quickest price rebounds ever seen due to an expected shortfall in US almond production. But Almond Board of Australia CEO Tim Jackson says even before the heavens opened in the US, prices had started to falter due to ongoing freight challenges, as Olivia Carver reports.
If prices have gone through a fairly strong rebound in the last couple of months, it's probably the strongest rebound in pricing we've seen in the industry for 10 years. However, in the last couple of weeks, the pricing has levelled off and in some products gone down as the volatility in the market is being driven by some real issues with shipping capacity and the weather in California.
So what's happening with shipping capacity, first of all? What position are Australian almond growers and companies in at the moment when it comes to reaching those export markets?
The almond industry was advised on Friday by the government that the shipping congestion that is an international problem for all exporters and importers is not going away. It's at least a 3 to 5 year problem, and that any sort of relief to the congestion that a lot of ports are suffering at the moment, it won't be solved until 2023.
What impact does that have on the market and the industry in Australia?
It's just providing some long-winded lead times on delivering stock. There's a lot of uncertainty around when that stock can leave the port and when it's going to arrive at its destination. So as we enter a period of volatility in pricing, exporters are in a tricky situation where they're selling at one price, and then if it takes undue time to arrive at the other end, they can create a bit of uncertainty around the acceptability of the value when it gets to the other end. So there's some real challenges there in ensuring that everyone in the supply chain behaves in an ethical manner.
And what's happening in California now?
There's been some record rainfalls right along California. I read this morning in the Los Angeles Times that Sacramento had 4.5 inches of rain in 24 hours. So the drought appears to have well and truly broken, which will have an impact on their current crop, but the early information is that the rain has finally arrived. They need an above record rainfall for their winter, and they're off to a flying start by the sound of things.
So it's looking like prices are going to drop in reaction to that globally, is that right?
So it might have the opposite effect. It might actually reduce the potential of the crop if there's a lot of water damage. I remember when we had drought 10 years ago and it broke with a similar way, we had orchards in Mildura, for instance, that were under a metre of water. It didn't do a lot for the orchards back then. So it's a bit early to tell, but the fact that it's broken is good news longer term for those growers. But what it does for the market in the short term is a little bit unclear at this stage.
I'm hearing there's the expectation that prices may return to the average levels we've seen of around $7.40 a kilogram next year. Is that right?
That's what the marketers and processors are indicating, that they would anticipate that there's a return to more average sort of return, which is great news for growers who have invested heavily in the industry.
So what's going to drive that return to average prices now if the California drought does break and we've got these shipping issues? What is playing in the growers' favour here?
That's a good question. From a point of view of the supply and demand imbalance, that California has generated a market for 3.1 billion pounds, so that we know that there is a demand out there for a 3.1 billion pound crop. If that crop comes in at 2.8, which is what everyone's estimating, before we actually assess any ongoing damage due to the rain that's started to fall, you would think that there is an imbalance in the supply and demand that's been created by that monster crop the previous year. So that should level out prices at a sustainable level going forward. There'll be the old peak and troughs as buyers and sellers try to get the upper hand in the short term.
Griffith farmer Paul Rosetto sells almonds to grower cooperative Almond Co. and says the rise in global demand has led to a 6% increase in their pool prices for 2021, moving from $5.20 a kilogram to $5.50. It's still well off the 10-decade average of around $7, but the cost of production is down with more water available.
$5.20 is starting to get a bit skinny. So, every dollar we can get above that $5.20 is very much appreciated. The water prices are low, but right now we don't need a lot of water. We usually start to run out of water in the new year if it's too dry.
Growers are also expecting a bounce back in yields this year.
This year's looking very good. The trees are looking very healthy. They've appreciated the rain, disease. There's not a lot of disease that I can see as compared to last year. And our crops were down last year about 16% on the average. So we're expecting a bounce back. And some of the trees look really, really good.
That's Griffith almond grower Paul Rosetto speaking to Olivia Carver. It's coming up to 13 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
In northwest New South Wales, multi-general tree planting is binding together the environment and farming. It was during the 1960s when Robin Watson came to settle on a farm in the Boggabri district and saw years of flooding had eroded the riverbanks. Since planting that very first tree all those decades ago, Robin has seen biodiversity grow alongside grain crops, as she told Lara Webster.
I started planting trees and grasses down over the side of the banks to try and give the banks a bit of stability. And over the years, that grew up and the banks became quite stable. And so then we planted trees in rows along the top of the banks on our side, fenced it off so that no stock could get onto the banks or around the little trees. And that gave great stability to the banks. And then we started to find that it was bringing lots of birds and animals, insects, to that area. Then later on when we started growing cotton, we started planting lots more trees around fields to stop what was the so-called drift on the cotton. And then in later years we've been joining up those patches of vegetation, so that now we've got long linkages of trees, rows of trees and grassland around our fields, up to remnant vegetation around the farms. And we've found that it's given us a great biodiversity across our fields. And I notice the birds and that come back round, even around our house, is just amazing.
And since those decades ago, when Robin first began her biodiversity project, her family are now all pitching in, including daughter-in-law Heike Watson, who's been planting trees ever since she arrived at the farm.
I've probably been planting trees ever since I turned up here, occasionally, because that's just what we do here.
And so when did you turn up here?
About 16 years ago. I'm a ring-in from Germany.
That's a lot of trees in 16 years. You must have gotten really good.
Well, I think I can plant a tree or two all right now, yeah. Been taught well.
Tell me, as you mentioned there, you have been helping to plant trees over those 16 years. What was it like for you when you came here those 16 years ago to now, and how, as we've heard, things have changed here?
I guess planting trees really has grown in me big time, just because I've learned how amazing they are, not only just to give us oxygen, I guess, but just to see and to hear and learn how they have been helping with very different things over the years, and as they have learned. And I guess the Watson family has always been very encouraging and inviting to universities to do a lot of different research here on this farm. And just I see the value of evolving and learning from those things, and to just try and put it into practice. That's been a great thing to see.
What have the benefits been when it comes to your farm here, which is, you know, a cropping operation?
It does help us being better farmers, not because it makes us smarter. It's just amazing to see the wildlife that gets attracted into those areas, mm-hmm. which helps us to fight our insects, our pest insects in the crops, which is a huge help. Helps us to cut down our insecticide sprays and other sprays immensely. That's been one of the biggest outcomes, and why we're keen to continue to do what we're doing, because we see that it helps us to be environmentally friendly.
Heike's 9-year-old daughter, Xanthia, has also been one of the very important planters. How many trees do you reckon you might have planted in your career so far?
Oh, a hard question.
A big question.
quite a few.
Quite lots.
Yeah.
Probably. Lots. Do you like planting these trees?
Some days it's all right, but other days, like, it's just too hot and bothering.
Just rather do something in the cool somewhere.
Yeah.
What are you learning when you plant the trees?
Well, I've learned that once the tree grows up, their roots are going to stop the riverbank from erosion. They're going to prevent it from erosion, and that if once they grow up and their leaves like spread, the leaves are going to shade over the river, and that's going to make it cooler. Therefore, it's going to make native fishies live longer.
We were talking, Xanthia, about friends coming out and being able to help, and especially, you know, this year as well. Tell me, how fun is it to have your friends here helping?
Well, with our friends out here, it just makes it a lot more entertaining, because you have someone to talk with, someone to play with, and just you just don't get so bored.
For Robin Watson, it means a lot to see her family carrying on her work.
I think it's wonderful to think that each generation now on our farm has seen the benefits of what we started. I always say I won't see the benefits of the trees I'm planting now, but Xanthia's generation will see it, because they'll be big trees when she grows up, and it'll be of use to her generation. So I think each generation should leave something for the next, and I think that's one thing that we've done.
That's Robin Watson speaking there to Lara Webster about the multi-generational tree planting on their Boggabri farm. Well, let's quickly turn to wine, and the World Trade Organization will look at China's tariffs on imported Australian wine, but it's not expected to be a silver bullet. Tony Battelain explains what the process is at the moment.
So yesterday, the dispute settlement body of the World Trade Organization met, and they have agreed to establish a panel so that we can now investigate the case between Australia and China about why those tariffs were implemented.
And then how long are you thinking the process will take?
Unfortunately, it's quite a long process. So it's a 2 to 3 year process. We recently had a case with Canada, which was resolved before its final report, and that took us 3 years. So it's a long process. There is no silver bullet that will arise at the end of it, but it is very important to us strategically to demonstrate to our trading partners and to consumers that we do not dump wine and we do not have subsidised product. So it's going to have some long-running effects. We've done some great efforts to diversify markets, but it's not something you can do overnight. So the next couple of years are going to be very difficult for us.
Tony Badalane from the Australian Grape and Wine, and he's the chief executive. He was talking to Cassie Huff. Let's go to Markets Casino Cattle, Doug Robson.
Good afternoon. There was 900 head yards, that's up by 130, consisting of a good supply of young cattle and a fair penning of cows. Quality of the young cattle was mixed with several runs of well-bred cattle along with a fair number of planter types. Competition was stronger with restocker weaner steers selling up to 30 cents dearer for the well-bred lightweights. They sell from 584 to 832 cents, calves up to 882. Restocker weaner heifers made similar gains. They sell from 530 to 736 cents. Only a few yearlings, the steers stopped at 570 and the heifer sold up to 552. The odd grown steer sold up to 409 cents to process and up to 452 to feed. Cow market saw medium weight cows sell 5 cents dearer and more in places, while heavy cows held firm. Three score medium weights average 378, heavy cows sold from 380 to 394, best of the bulls 352 cents. Doug Robson at Casino.
Let's go to Yash Sheep and Lambs, Graham Richard.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers increased to 13,700 and 10,000 were new season lambs. The quality is slipping as more lambs grown to wool, store lambs were better supplied and there were mostly trade and heavy lambs penned. The market sold to a cheaper trend of $18 to $22. The new season store lambs 114 to 168 and heavier weights reached 193. Trades to 24 kilos 165 to 214 with the better lambs averaging 850 cents. 24 to 26 205 to 221 or 800 cents on average and over 26 kilos 226 to 255. Old trades 165 to 196 or 760 to 800 cents. The heavy lambs 177 to 254 with extra heavies reaching 270. Mutton numbers eased and all grades were penned. Prices also eased 15 to 20. The medium weight ewes 132 to 164. Heavy crossbred ewes 186 to 196 and merinos 153 to 170. The balance of the lambs and sheep are still to be sold and this has been Graham Richard at Yass.
Let's go to Carcor Sheep and Lambs, David Monk.
Numbers were back by 300 for a yarding of 5,150 lambs. It was a pretty good quality yarding with a good selection of trade weight new season lambs along with odd pens of heavyweights. There were also fair numbers of young lambs to suit the restockers and there were a few pens of merinos yarded. Trade weight new season lambs were $18 to $25 cheaper, selling from $170 to $218 to average between $8.15 and $8.50 cents a kilogram. Heavyweight lambs were up to $35 cheaper, with the new season lambs over 24 kilograms selling from $210 to $240, while the heavyweight old lambs sold from $210 to $265. The few merino lambs were $15 to $22 cheaper, with trade weight selling from $146 to $190. Restocker lambs were $7 to $11 cheaper, selling from $120 to $191. Hoggets sold to $155. There were 1,030 mostly good quality mutton yarded, where most grades were 13 to 15 dearer. Merino ewes sold from 112 to 153, while crossbred ewes sold from 100 to 210. Merino weathers sold from 140 to 190. This is David Monk at CTLX for MLA.
Let's go to Cow Sheep and Lambs and Rob Pearce.
Good afternoon, Michael. Lamb numbers remain steady for 5,300. Quality continues to be good with mainly trades penned. Store lambs increased in supply. Heavyweights were limited in number. Medium and heavy trade new seasons were $8 to $10 cheaper. 2022 kilos, 189 to 205. 22 to 24, 202 to 210, averaging 840 to 870 cents. Heavyweights were one cheaper. 24 to 26, 230 to 236, 26 to 30, 237 to 241, averaging 830 to 860. Stores were down $10 and sold from 127 to 191. And mutton numbers fell and quality was mixed. Heavy first cross ewes were three dearer. They sold from 200 to 210, averaging 635 cents. And it's been Rob Pearce from Cowra and MLA.
Let's go to Mossvale now.
Good afternoon, Michael. Numbers D's for a total yarding of 424 mixed quality cattle. Yearlings made up the bulk of the offering, mostly going to feeder orders or backgrounders, with a limited supply to suit the trade. There are a few good pens and weaners to suit the restockers, with lightweight steers reaching 900 cents and the heifer portion topping at 820. The quality of grown cattle was plainer, and there were 55 mostly prime heavy cows. All the usual buyers were operating, along with some extra restocker orders, selling to a variable market. Heavy trade steers up to 7 deer are 525 to 556. Trade heifers 9 better to average 540. Yearling steers to feed lifted 2, reaching 618. And those to backgrounders topped at 647. Feeder heifers were cheaper, averaging 499. Weaner steers returning the paddock 550 to 900.
Thanks for that, David Kent with Mossvale Cattle. You're listening to the Country Hour. It's time for the news.